Okay, don't skip ahead. I'm going to talk to you about climate change. And I know it can get depressing or infuriating, but our show takes a different approach. It's Laura Lynch, and I'm the host of What on Earth, and we're all about solutions and hope. And I promise, no matter how overwhelming climate change might feel, we're with you on the journey to fix this mess. So listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
The surgery was successful. However, tests after the operation found cancer had been present.
The royal family is used to wowing the world with their pageantry and grandeur. Today, a reminder of their humanity. Catherine, Princess of Wales, has cancer. The surprise announcement is setting off global reaction and putting an end to weeks of wild speculation. Where was she? How was she? After abdominal surgery, we now know Kate's undergoing treatment, just like her father-in-law, the King. Welcome to Your World Tonight. I'm Tom Harrington. It is Friday, March 22nd, coming up at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Also on the podcast. Horror in Moscow. Dozens are reported dead as gunmen storm a concert hall in the Russian capital. Authorities there are calling it a terrorist attack. And in Sudan.
Millions who are facing terrible hunger levels. We're verging on famine now.
Civil war, political chaos, and human suffering. Aid groups say there is overwhelming need in the African country, and they're calling on the international community to do more. As millions can attest, cancer is the great, terrible equalizer. It sickens people you know and people you don't. The famous, the anonymous, movie stars, moviegoers. Now today, after weeks of speculation, even conspiracies about her absence from the public, we learn the Princess of Wales is being treated for cancer. In a video message, Catherine says it was found after abdominal surgery in January, and she's now undergoing chemotherapy. Meaning, the current King Charles and the future Queen of England are both battling the disease. Chris Brown has our top story from London tonight.
It has been an incredibly tough couple of months for our entire family.
The question of what was going on with Catherine, the Princess of Wales, who was absent from public view since Christmas, had fueled furious internet conspiracy theories for weeks. Then, Friday night, in a surprising video, she provided the answers herself.
In January, I underwent major abdominal surgery in London. And at the time, it was thought that my condition was non-cancerous. The surgery was successful. However, tests after the operation found cancer had been present.
Catherine did not say specifically what her cancer diagnosis was, only that she began treatment at the end of February.
My medical team therefore advised that I should undergo a course of preventative chemotherapy, and I'm now in the early stages of that treatment. This, of course, came as a huge shock.
She said the first concern for her and her husband, Prince William, was to assure the couple's three children that their mother would be all right. On the streets of London, the unexpected news caught people off guard.
But I'm absolutely devastated because she's a sweetheart.
It's incredibly sad whenever anybody, you know, gets cancer.
Without knowing precisely what kind of cancer the 42-year-old princess is dealing with, makes it difficult to assess how she will progress, says Vancouver oncologist Charlene Gill.
The most common cancers we think about are colorectal cancers, cancers that arise from the large bowel.
Gill says the fact she used the term preventative chemo is significant.
The goal of further treatment or preventative treatment is to try to keep the cancer away and reduce the risk of recurrence. So that's an optimistic phrase to use.
Before tonight, speculation about Catherine had been fueled by her husband skipping public appearances and Kensington Palace handing out significantly manipulated family photos. Emily Nash, the royal correspondent for Hello magazine, expects the overwhelming sentiment now will be sympathy.
It gives context to Prince William pulling out of the memorial service for his late godfather, King Constantine. So that has been explained away. You know, even arguably the furore about the photoshopping of the Mother's Day picture can be forgiven now knowing what she's been going through.
Catherine is a third person associated with the royal family to announce they have cancer after King Charles and Prince Andrew's ex-wife, Sarah Ferguson, the Duchess of York. Tonight, in a statement, the king praised Catherine's courage for speaking out, but her illness will diminish the family's already reduced public presence. Catherine was supposed to return to duties after Easter, and now she says she'll be off until she's better. Chris Brown, CBC News, London.
Spectators at a concert hall on the outskirts of Moscow are trying to flee what Russian officials are calling a terrorist attack. Russian media says dozens of people are dead and more than 100 wounded at the Crocus City Hall. Multiple shooters were allegedly dressed in camouflage. They reportedly walked into the building and opened fire, seemingly at random. They also threw explosives. Part of the building's roof has apparently collapsed. White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby spoke from the White House, and he says the images were hard to watch.
You got to recognize that there's some moms and dads and brothers and sisters and sons and daughters that haven't gotten the news yet. And this is going to be a tough day. So our thoughts are with them.
ISIS is now claiming responsibility for the attack. The Culture Ministry has announced all entertainment and mass events in Russia have been canceled. Earlier this month, several Western embassies in Russia told their citizens to avoid crowded places. A Canadian in a Russian prison has reached out to CBC News, fearing for his life. Paul Whelan was arrested 5 years ago in Moscow and later convicted of espionage, charges he vehemently denies. Though he was born in Ottawa, Whelan is also an American citizen. Both countries have been working for his release from a remote penal colony where he's serving a 16-year sentence. Briar Stewart now with details from Whelan's unexpected phone call to her.
Thank you. Hi, Paul. Thanks.
When the call came in from Russia saying that Paul Whelan was on the phone and he wanted to be connected, it came as a surprise. CBC News had been trying to get an interview with Whelan for a couple of years when Thursday evening he suddenly called from the remote penal colony in Mordovia, Russia.
You know, there does need to be more support at all levels to stop this sort of thing by rogue governments that think that it's okay to take citizens hostage and hold them for years and years and years.
So do you feel more concerned for your safety now than before?
I do. Oh, yeah, definitely.
Whelan wanted to talk about his fears after what happened to Alexei Navalny, Russia's imprisoned opposition leader who died suddenly in an Arctic penal colony last month.
It's unfortunate what happened with Navalny. But it also shows that this is what Russia does.
Western officials blame Navalny's death on the Kremlin, which dismissed those claims. On Sunday, after President Vladimir Putin was re-elected for another 6 years, he claimed that he agreed to release Navalny shortly before his death in a prisoner swap. U.S. officials say Navalny wasn't part of any formal discussions, but there have been media reports that the deal could have also freed Whelan, along with U.S. journalist Evan Gershkovich, in exchange for Vadim Krasikov, who is serving a life sentence for murder in Germany for killing an opponent of Putin's in Berlin.
I don't know the details of an exchange proposal.
Whelan says he had a call with the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken last month, who reassured him his case is a priority. And just on Wednesday, Canada's ambassador to Russia met with him at the penal colony.
This is a somewhat complicated case.
Rob Oliphant is the parliamentary secretary to Canada's foreign affairs minister.
We continue to be worried. Anything that the Putin regime does that threatens a Canadian citizen is something of concern to us.
Canada says it's working alongside the U.S., the U.K. and Ireland to try and secure his release because Whelan holds multiple citizenships.
Yeah, I think it's high time my government's got me home.
Because after 5 years, Whelan feels he could be running out of time. Briar Stewart, CBC News, London.
Still ahead on the podcast, a humanitarian crisis you hear little about. Sudan is a country in chaos. Plus, life under a new security law may change the Hong Kong the world has known for decades. And can a blackout be a good thing? Businesses in Niagara Falls, Ontario, hope for a windfall next month when a rare solar eclipse darkens the skies. The wars in Gaza and Ukraine have captured much of the world's attention. But for the last year, another humanitarian nightmare has been unfolding in Sudan. The civil war there is worsening. Aid agencies are pleading for more help. And the UN says the country now faces the world's greatest displacement crisis. Before today's Royal News broke, we had asked Chris Brown to explore the disaster in Sudan. And he filed this story on a looming famine that could affect millions.
Sudan is no longer a functioning country, a collapsed state ripped apart by a war between two rival generals. The capital, Khartoum, has been decimated. Video from earlier this month shows one suburb where the fighting was intense, where every building in sight is in ruins. Vast parts of the countryside have been turned into battlegrounds too, meaning the crops that sustain Sudan's population of 49 million people could not be planted or harvested.
Millions who are facing terrible hunger levels. We're verging on famine now.
Carl Schrembri is with the Norwegian Refugee Council. The NGO has several hundred staff members on the ground in Sudan. They're running food kitchens trying to meet an overwhelming need from an estimated 9 million people who have been forced from their homes. Almost 1.7 million people have fled the neighboring countries as well, Chad, Egypt, and South Sudan. And Schrembri says international assistance has been utterly inadequate.
We're talking in the 10, 15% of all that is needed.
Both sides are accused by the UN of committing atrocities, but many who fled to Chad from West Darfur have related especially harrowing accounts of sexual violence and executions at the hands of the Rapid Support Forces. Edem Wasornu is with the UN Office for Humanitarian Affairs.
A humanitarian travesty is playing out in Sudan under a veil of international inaction and inattention.
On the ground, the war appears deadlocked, with neither side willing to negotiate, perhaps because each has acquired foreign arms suppliers. The UN has claimed the Rapid Support Forces are being supplied by the United Arab Emirates, while the Sudanese Armed Forces have links to Iran.
We're seeing these Sudan becoming embroiled in a more geostrategic competition.
Khalou Kaher, a London-based Sudan analyst, says the prize for the winning side is access to a strategic position on the Red Sea.
For any country that is able to, frankly, make use of Sudan's weak military actors, who are increasingly more and more reliant on international patronage, this presents a very enticing prospect.
Sudan's war is now also jeopardizing its neighbors, especially South Sudan. The impoverished country was already struggling with an influx of war refugees, and now its main money earner, oil, is in jeopardy. A pipeline through Sudan to the Red Sea has been damaged by the war, curtailing exports. That's increased political instability as the fallout from Sudan's war ripples across the region. Chris Brown, CBC News, London.
In Hong Kong, a new sweeping national security law is now in effect. So-called Article 23 was passed unanimously by pro-Beijing legislators this week. They defend it as necessary to protect the region, while critics say it further erodes freedoms and changes Hong Kong as we know it. Sasha Petrasek has more on the fear and the chilling effect.
Outside a Hong Kong courthouse, the shrill voice of a lone woman protesting. Chanting, democracy will prevail, while inside, 12 people were recently sent to jail for demonstrating during a wave of unrest 5 years ago. It's a brave chant in today's Hong Kong, one that could land her in prison too, under a tough new law covering sedition and treason and collusion with foreign forces. The law was unanimously passed by the city's Beijing-dominated legislature this week. A proud historic moment, says Chief Executive John Lee. Made necessary, say supporters, by months of pro-democracy protests in 2019 that brought millions to the streets, first peacefully, then more violently. A year later, Beijing imposed its own tough security law in response, one with a 100% conviction rate.
National security is about the security of China.
The city needed to get even tougher with its own version, says Hong Kong government advisor Ronnie Tong, in ways that shouldn't worry most Hong Kongers.
seditious intent under the law only covers a few specific areas, not general criticism of the government.
Critics say ever-tightening rules have changed the city's old free atmosphere. Former Hong Kong pro-democracy lawmaker Emily Lau is among the few who dares speak out.
Some people are scared, but they are so scared they dare not even say they are scared. And now people cannot demonstrate. There's no public assembly, no marches, and that's very sad because that was what Hong Kong was famous for.
Edmund Wan was jailed for about a year under the old laws for promoting democracy as a radio host, known as Gigs. Now, with Hong Kong's new law,
I'm damn sure that I will be put in prison for at least 2 to 3 years.
Wan is seeking asylum as a refugee in Vancouver.
I want the world to know that those 90 lawmakers are not voted by the Hong Kong people, but by the Chinese government in a way to cheat the world.
Canada, Britain, and the European Union have criticized the law as too sweeping. The UN's human rights chief says it may violate international rights. Hong Kong's international business community is also worried it might inadvertently violate the broad new law, possibly adding to the ongoing exodus of foreigners and Hong Kongers. Sasha Petrusik, CBC News, Toronto.
The search of a Winnipeg area landfill for the remains of two Indigenous women is getting provincial and federal support. Each level of government will chip in $20 million. Winnipeg police believe Morgan Harris and Mercedes Myron were victims of a serial killer and the remains disposed of at the Prairie Green landfill in 2022. The previous Conservative government didn't fund a search, citing a study which found it was risky and too expensive. Untraceable ghost guns are a growing problem across Canada. The weapons can be made by basically anyone, anywhere, with a 3D printer. Ellen Morrow went to Edmonton, where the police force there is making the guns themselves. They're trying to learn more and get ahead of this alarming trend.
We printed this to demonstrate how the supports work.
Larry Snydel is a firearms expert with the Alberta Law Enforcement Response Teams, showing us the lab where he works. On a table in the corner, a 3D printer. Beside it, several 3D printed guns.
What do you think people should know about these?
They're dangerous. Just stay away from them.
Snydel tries to recreate 3D printed guns found at crime scenes. Known as ghost guns, the 3D printed weapons are untraceable, with no serial numbers anywhere on them.
Somebody had attempted to print a whole bunch of guns. We're able to recreate what he did, end up to get a functional firearm, to get a conviction on that.
This work is keeping Larry busy as police across Canada seize more of these weapons. Last spring, dozens were uncovered in a first-of-its-kind nationwide sting. Since then, police departments told CBC News they continue to see an increase in the guns.
The simplicity of somebody being able to acquire these guns is something everybody should be concerned about.
Edmonton Police Deputy Chief Devin LaForce.
They are massive, massive concern.
And this gives us what we're going to print.
Snydel sits down at a computer to show us just how easy these guns are to make.
And when I'm ready, I just hit print plate.
Instruction data files are downloaded from the internet and sent to the printer. The receiver, or the frame of the gun, the part where the serial number would normally be, can be 3D printed in under 10 hours. The metal parts needed to complete the gun are then added.
What's happening now? People are experimenting on different things.
Canada's new gun control law makes it a crime to have the computer data files for the purpose of making a gun. The law has another section targeting 3D printed guns, making it a requirement to have a gun license to buy some of the metal parts needed, but that section of the law has not come into force yet, and Public Safety Canada did not provide a clear timeline for when it will. So right now, those parts are still readily available to buy without a license.
Now it's just a little bit of catch-up.
Deputy Chief LaForce describes the challenge for police.
When directions on how to make a gun are onto the internet, as much as we can try and make it illegal, it exists.
Everybody's got eyes and ears protection on.
That reality makes Snidel's work even more important. He's testing out a 3D printed gun he just completed.
We got a crack in the receiver after 10.
A 3D printed gun is not always reliable, but experts say that's not what matters.
One round is bad enough, and we got 10 out of there.
Ellen Morrow, CBC News, Edmonton.
If you drive an electric vehicle, buckle up. Insurance premiums for EVs could be on the rise in the next few years. The insurance industry is grappling with the shift from gas-powered cars to electric alternatives and how their claims cost much more. Philippe de Montigny explains.
Benjamin Vassal and his partner never expected repairing their Tesla would take 2 months. Their holidays in northern Ontario took an awful turn.
We hit a deer around 90 kilometers per hour. So the front of the car got damaged, the lights. And then we realized that the total cost was $18,000, which was really expensive compared to what we thought the car needed.
The couple's insurer covered the bill, but Vassal fears having to dish out more for insurance down the road.
But then you're thinking about the insurance policy and how it could go up, because it's happening everywhere else.
A recent Morningstar DBRS report looked at the UK, where EV uptake is much higher than in Canada. The average cost of insurance there soared last year, up 72% for electric and only 29% for gas and diesel. The report says Canadians could see their premiums increase too, report author Victor Adesanya.
Insurance is a pool business. The insurance premiums from a lot of people are used to pay claims for very few people. Right now in that pool, we have very few EVs.
But that'll change, he says, as EV production ramps up in Canada. And sales of conventional cars and trucks are phased out by 2035.
Where the difference is...
Rob Dupree is the National Director of Consumer and Industry Relations at the Insurance Bureau of Canada.
Some electric vehicles just have higher repair costs. And that's a result of more expensive replacement parts that aren't as readily available, or also the skilled labor that it may take for these repairs on these vehicles.
Some colleges are hoping to change that, training a new generation of EV mechanics. Colin Simpson helped design a full EV technician program at George Brown College in Toronto. He says enrollment is strong, showing appetite for these skills.
It's just been over a year and a half now that we've been offering the program. It has almost 700 students.
Back home, Benjamin Vassal worries costly and complicated repairs could turn people off from electric vehicles.
That can be really a full stop. Just, I'm not going to go electric because of insurance policies too expensive.
The couple first decided to get an electric car to save on gas. But with insurance costs being higher and charging costs going up, these savings are slowly melting away. Philippe de Montigny, CBC News, Welland, Ontario.
The protests by fish harvesters in Newfoundland and Labrador are over. They have reached a marketing deal with the provincial government. The Fish, Food and Allied Workers Union is calling it a victory. On Wednesday, hundreds of harvesters blocked access to the legislature and delaying the provincial budget for a day. In case you haven't heard, there's a dramatic solar eclipse coming next month. One of the best places to see it in Canada, Niagara Falls, Ontario. It falls along the path of totality, where the moon will completely cover the sun. That is, if the weather cooperates. But thousands are gambling, it will be clear and sunny that day. So they're heading to the region to catch this rare celestial event. As Katie Nicholson reports, it's creating a big tourist boom and an equally big headache.
Gregory Virch swings the door open and steps out to his winery's gravel parking lot.
So we should be able to fit probably about 50 vehicles in here.
Okay. His Eclipse and Sips wine event sold out almost as soon as he floated the idea. He gestures over to three gazebos set against the vines.
So this is where we're going to try and set up for the eclipse.
Inside, one of his vast silver tanks is full of Merlot to be served on the big day. but he's worried his small winery will be overrun.
So for us, that's always an issue with, say, washroom capacities, with parking spots and things like this. So we're actually hiring or we're bringing in extra staff.
The Niagara region will have one of the best views of April 8th's solar eclipse. Demand for hotel rooms has skyrocketed, and so have the prices. Some rooms going for more than $1,000.
It's the same for Super Bowl tickets.
David Carroll oversees three hotels on the American side and three on the Canadian side, including this one.
Everything is here that you could possibly need.
All pretty much sold out.
I'm shocked. I've been in the business a long time. I'm shocked the amount of people that are coming up to this part of the United States and Canada to see an eclipse for 4 minutes. I'm really surprised.
But it's no surprise to Jim Diodati, the mayor of Niagara Falls. He's been involved in planning for this for 2 years.
We're preparing for the worst, hoping for the best. We know there could end up being upwards of 1 million people in the city at one time.
The last time the falls saw anything near that number was in 2012 when Nick Belenda crossed the Horseshoe Falls on a tightrope. 150,000 showed up. The city has ordered tens of thousands of certified eclipse viewing glasses, but still expects to run out.
You know, we're going to need a lot more. It's kind of like get a bigger boat in Jaws, and that's kind of where we are. We're like, get more glasses.
Police forces have been coordinating with others on a safety plan, anticipating hours of gridlock throughout the region, especially if visitors from Toronto flood the one major highway. Constable Phil Gavin is with Niagara Regional Police.
There is a mathematical number, so how many cars can be on the road in the Niagara region. If we overwhelm that, there's only so much we can do.
They're asking people to plan ahead, make sure they have food, water, and medication with them in case they're stranded. Back at Between the Lines Winery, Gregory Virch stands in the sleet by the gazebos where he hopes to take it all in.
But we'll get a chance to do some wine tasting out here. Maybe a little bit, maybe we'll have a little bit better weather than a blizzard for the eclipse.
Of course, if the weather is anything like the last few cloudy, snowy March days, all that planning, the anticipation, the worry, and those glasses for nothing. Katie Nicholson, CBC News, Niagara on the Lake.
We'll end tonight where we began, the announcement from Kensington Palace. The Princess of Wales telling the world she's being treated for cancer. Kate's personal message in a video comes after weeks of questions about her health and her whereabouts. As to her decision to announce it now, she says this 42-year-old mother was thinking of those closest to her, her three children.
But most importantly, it has taken us time to explain everything to George, Charlotte, and Louis in a way that's appropriate for them and to reassure them that I'm going to be okay. As I've said to them, I am well. I'm getting stronger every day by focusing on the things that will help me heal in my mind, body, and spirit. At this time, I'm also thinking of all those whose lives have been affected by cancer. For everyone facing this disease, in whatever form, please do not lose faith or hope. You are not alone.
This has been Your World Tonight for Friday, March 22nd. I'm Tom Harrington. Thanks for listening tonight. Stay safe and take care of each other.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.